Bishop on air, back at it. Everybody popping into the live chat this morning. Ron, Joseph, William, Ricardo, Sergio, Warbot, David, Ed, Brian, Austin, Huckleberry, Treston. Appreciate you guys being here. We'll hear a bit of Governor J.B. Pritzker talking about the ongoing migrant crisis in the state of Illinois. He was asked about the state being a sanctuary state. So we'll hear his thoughts. We'll also review just a few things of the 320 some odd pieces of legislation that the Illinois House passed last week. And one thing they didn't touch on, the Invest in Kids School Choice Scholarship Program that expired at the tail end of last year. But of course, we've got to get to the latest in gun litigation, with the U.S. Supreme Court taking up the ATF rule, expanding what is a firearm component. So we'll touch on that as well. Just a few segments here, and we'll let you guys get on with your day. I'm Greg Bishop. Thanks again for hanging out. Email me anytime, bishoponair@gmail.com. And follow me on X, on Facebook, here on YouTube, and elsewhere. Just search Bishop on Air. Appreciate you guys being here. And we'll get right into the quote-unquote ghost gun case and what impact, if any, it would have for Illinois. So stay tuned. Ah, Roman, I see you there. Good morning. The U.S. Supreme Court agrees to take a case challenging the ATF's rule on unserialized firearms. How's it going to impact Illinois, if at all, if the ATF's rule is struck down? Well, it's still going to be a bit before we actually have the case in front of the U.S. Supreme Court, but they have accepted it. Good morning. I'm Greg Bishop. Thanks for hanging out. It's Bishop on Air. Taking a look at the latest, and of course, this is a case that's gotten a lot of attention as you've got the various sides of this talking about violent crime and firearms that aren't traceable and the plethora of firearms that are considered quote unquote ghost guns being found in a city like Chicago by Chicago police. So you have here, ultimately what happened is an administrative rule that the ATF put in place concerning lower receivers and whether or not an unfinished lower receiver is considered a firearm. Because if you have, the lower receiver of, say, an AR-15, it needs to be milled, right? It needs to be drilled out appropriately if it's only 80% complete to get it to be 100% complete. And within the Second Amendment community, there's a large space for those who like to make their own firearms. And the ATF, as I checked previously on their website, even said that, unserialized firearms are legal and you don't have to have a serial number if it's something you made for yourself. So interesting to see that that language. How it could be interpreted as this case proceeds. So privately made firearms. Here's what the ATF, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, has to say about privately made firearms. So if you go to the ATF's website, you can pull this up yourself and see this language that they have of what privately made firearms are. So pull this up on their website, atf.gov. And it says, privately made firearms are firearms, including a frame or receiver, that have been completed, assembled, or otherwise produced by a person other than a licensed manufacturer. Privately made firearms are also made without a serial number placed by a licensed manufacturer at the time the firearm was produced. However, not all privately made firearms are illegal, and not all firearms are required to have a serial number. ATF's compiled some information on the different types of privately made firearms and things to consider while owning one. So different types of privately made firearms categorized into different groups. There's 10 types of privately made firearms: pistols, revolvers, rifle, shotgun, frame, or receiver. Machine gun conversion device, destructive device, machine gun, firearm silencer, and any other weapon. And here are examples that you can see. So it kind of shows all the different types of privately made firearms. And I think a big question is the frame or receiver component here that has people, you know, ultimately questioning what the bottom line is in this case. So the ATF goes on to say, things to consider: individuals who make their own firearms may use a 3D printing process or any other process as long as the firearm is detectable as defined by the Gun Control Act. You do not have to add a serial number or register the privately made firearm if you do not engage in the business of making firearms for livelihood or for profit. So essentially, again, what this spells out is, you know, you can make a firearm at home just as long as you're not transferring it to somebody else if it's for your own use. So getting into the weeds here, challenges involving privately made firearms. The ATF says privately made firearms are commonly referred to as ghost guns because it can be difficult to track them. Investigating crimes involving unserialized privately made firearms can create difficulty in tracing the origins of the firearm and linking them to related crimes. From 2016 through 2021, there are approximately 45,240 suspected privately made firearms reported to ATF as having been recovered by law enforcement from potential crime scenes, including 692 homicides and attempted homicides. These issues have led to some states passing additional laws related to privately made firearms. And those states include the state of Illinois. So that's a little bit of what the ATF has to say about privately made firearms. And they categorize these, and even gun control groups have gotten this into the lexicon, calling them, quote, ghost guns. And there's an interesting thing here, too, in this overall conversation. And if you guys have at all followed Cody Wilson's work, he is kind of considered the grandfather of 3D printed guns. It's been a decade plus since he had, I think it was called the Equalizer. I'm not sure what that first firearm he made was. But it was just a plastic single shot, you know, polymer type of firearm that he made. Then it evolved from there with other 3D printing types of technology. And he would make available the schematics, the computer assisted design files. These are just, you know, like files that you can get on like a PDF or a Word document. These CAD files he made available for all of the designs that they would come up with, kind of like open source of sorts. And if you recall, and this has been years ago, he had the federal government come down on him trying to prohibit his company from making available these documents, which, you know, not only raised the issue of Second Amendment rights to keep and bear arms, but it even got into the issue of First Amendment rights, because, again, these are just documents that he was sharing. But the concern was that, you know, the other actors, bad actors, opposition states could possibly get access to these things. So an interesting conversation to have about all of that. And that's totally tangential to what's going on with the case that the U.S. Supreme Court has agreed to hear when it comes to the ATF's rule on so-called ghost guns. And I think somebody who can really spell this out for us is Hannah Hill from the National Association for Gun Rights. She posted this on X yesterday, kind of explaining a bit about what to expect with the U.S. Supreme Court accepting the Garland v. Vanderstock case. And let's go ahead and hear it. Got that pulled up. Give me 2 seconds. Get this where we need it and unmute that tab so we can hear Hannah explain what exactly this case is going to mean for the Second Amendment community.
Hey, y'all. We got some great news out of the Supreme Court this morning. The Supreme Court granted cert in a lawsuit challenging the ATF's ghost gun rule, which was more or less a backdoor ban on home-built firearms. And they did that by redefining what a firearm is under federal law to include 80% lowers. And that way, basically, FFLs couldn't sell them unless they're serialized. And anytime one fell into their hands, they had to serialize it, like if they brought it in for repair overnight or something like that. So this is excellent news for the Second Amendment. What this means for us is that the Supreme Court is finally taking seriously the many instances of ATF overreach when it comes to the Second Amendment. That said, this is an administrative law case. This is about whether or not the ATF went beyond the statutory definitions that Congress passed and acted beyond their executive mandate. So that means that for cases like ours, where we're challenging the Colorado ban on home-built firearms, there's not going to be necessarily an immediate impact because they're challenging whether the ATF went beyond their statutory mandate. We're challenging whether a state may, under Bruin and the Second Amendment, outright ban home-built firearms, which is what the state has done. So still, it's excellent news for the Second Amendment. The ATF has been out of control for years, especially that only ramped up under Joe Biden, although it didn't start with him. And this has been long overdue on the part of the Supreme Court. So we are thrilled to see this, and we look forward to seeing what the Supreme Court says about it.
So here you've got Hannah Hill from the National Association for Gun Rights talking about what kind of impact this will have in this space. And she mentioned it may not do anything for Colorado's laws. And they have a case challenging Colorado's ban on homemade firearms. What about Illinois and the ban that was enacted a couple of years ago now? Let's take a look at that piece of legislation that was ultimately signed, and this is from the state of Illinois' website, serialization of unfinished frames or receivers. And again, this is Illinois law. This is the law that Illinois passed. So let's go through here. It talks about different definitions, what's a bona fide supplier, firearms dealer, federal firearms manufacturer. Frame or receiver, it says, means a part or of a firearm that, when the complete weapon is assembled, is visible from the exterior and provides housing or a structure designed to hold or integrate one or more fire control components, even if pins or other attachments are required to connect those components to the housing or structure. For models of firearms in which multiple parts provide such housing or structure, the part or parts that the director of the Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and Explosives has determined are a frame or receiver constitute the frame or receiver. So maybe there you've got, if this ATF rule is struck down, could this possibly impact Illinois' law? So it goes on further to say, for purposes of this definition, fire control components means a component necessary for the firearm to initiate, complete, or continue the firing sequence, including any of the following: hammer, bolt, bolt carrier, breech block, cylinder, trigger mechanism, firing pin, striker, or slide rails. Then it goes into other definitions, talks about a three-dimensional printer means a computer or computer drive machine. capable of producing a three-dimensional object from a digital model. Undetectable firearm means a firearm constructed entirely of non-metal substances, a firearm that, after removal of all parts but the major components of the firearm, is not detectable by walk-through metal detectors calibrated and operated to detect security exemplar, or a firearm that is included in major components of a firearm, which, if subject to the type of detection commonly used at airports for security screening, would not generate an image that accurately depicts the shape and component of the firearm. Talks about undetectable, unfinished frame or receiver means any forging, casting, printing, extrusion, machined body, or similar article that has reached a stage in manufacturing where it may readily be completed, assembled, or converted to be a functional firearm, or is marketed or sold to the public to become used as the frame or receiver of a functional firearm once completed, assembled, and converted. Also talks about what unserialized means goes on there with more definitions. But then it's, it goes on to say, 180 days after the effective date of the Amendatory Act of the 102nd General Assembly, which I believe we're now in the 103rd General Assembly. Keep in mind, they're 2-year terms. So we're in the, second year of the 103rd General Assembly. So this measure passed a couple of years ago. Goes on to spell out even more of what the law spells out. Beginning 180 days after the effective date of this act, unless the party receiving the firearm is a firearms importer or federal firearms manufacturer, it's unlawful for any person to knowingly possess, purchase, transport, or receive a firearm that is not imprinted with a serial number by a federal firearms importer or federal firearms manufacturer in compliance with all federal laws and regulations regarding the manufacture and import of firearms, or a federal firearms manufacturer, firearms dealer, or federal licensed authorized to provide marking services in compliance with the unserialized firearm serialization process under subsection of this law. How the case that the U.S. Supreme Court could hear, they've agreed to take the case up about the ATF's rule that people say is the ATF making law through administrative process. And the big question here is, can executive agencies in the federal government make law through the administrative rule process in saying that unserialized, unfinished firearms components are considered firearms? So we'll be watching that and see how it impacts Illinois, if at all, when they do move forward and attempt to hear this case, whatever the outcome is going to be. And when are they going to hear it? It's a great question. Could be heard in the first quarter of next year and maybe get some kind of outcome thereafter. Other updates on litigation against gun laws. No updates on the Southern District of Illinois federal case. They've got some deadlines coming up next month to get their expert witnesses in the challenge against Illinois' gun ban. But you've also got other conversations happening about parts. And I know Todd Vandermeid, will have to have him on again here soon to delve into the challenge that the federal firearms licensees of Illinois have brought forward, which really deals with the gun ban and gun parts that are impacted by the ban. So that's another element of this ongoing conversation. So no real movement in the Southern District case challenging Illinois' gun ban, but there will be some movement in that in the weeks ahead, with the prospect of a possible trial expected in July. So we have Attorney Thomas Magg telling us that July 8th seems to be the date that they're going to move forward with the merits on that case. So there you have it. Just a little bit of an overview of at least how Illinois could be impacted by that U.S. Supreme Court case that they have agreed to take up. We'll be watching that, and you can stay tuned with us here with Bishop on Air. Just like, subscribe, and hit that notification bell. All right, make it happen. The ongoing migrant crisis across the country impacting non-border states like Illinois, and Governor J.B. Pritzker says that migrants in Illinois from the southern U.S. border are here legally seeking asylum, and saying that he's not going to move those individuals that are transported from the southern U.S. border to Chicago. He's not going to transfer them to other places throughout the state. He was asked about this at an unrelated news conference yesterday, and I think it's interesting to hear what his comments are on this issue. As the taxpayer cost continues to balloon with not just the costs for housing and food and other services, but also you've got the growing taxpayer cost from non-citizen health care that taxpayers subsidize. So where are we at in all of this? Welcome back, Bishop on Air. I'm Greg Bishop. Thanks for hanging out. Like, subscribe, hit that notification bell. Let's hear from Governor J.B. Pritzker about this question he was asked yesterday at an unrelated news conference in Peoria, where he was advocating for a change to state-regulated insurance plans. And that's another story entirely. As that measure passed the House late Thursday night, it's now going to go into the Senate, and it's a big issue that the governor has on his agenda for this year. Getting rid of things like step therapy and prior authorization and things like that. But the governor was asked off topic about Illinois being a sanctuary state, and he, I guess, didn't really like that term being used for some reason. Here's what the governor had to say.
I don't think I've ever used that language, and you can go back and, you know, 6 years, five and a quarter years in office, and when I ran. But if I have, forgive my, if it would be once, perhaps. The truth is that the Trust Act, which is a bill, a law that went into effect before I became governor, signed by the prior governor, is what's in place in Illinois. And essentially the idea here is that someone who is living here who's been undocumented and may have been here for years, getting pulled over because they were speeding should not be a reason to now pull somebody out of their car, arrest them, and send them to ICE at the federal level and have them deported. That oftentimes people are living here not just peacefully but productively, and that over time people have applied for and gotten permanent residency or citizenship. We should have a system like that, once again, by the way, that people can apply for, go through a process, and it's not a very good one as it is. We need comprehensive immigration reform. But I believe that that's a law that's been good for Illinois, the Trust Act. One other comment I would make. You know, there's a lot of hysteria that's going around about the fact that we have legal asylum seekers. They have papers, they're here legally in this country while they get a hearing, while they wait for a hearing, and that we're, you know, trying to provide them, those who don't have work authorization, and we're trying to get more work authorizations for them because there are jobs available in Illinois for them. We're just trying to provide them with some basic humanitarian care. And we've done that, I believe. I've seen the hysteria on Facebook, and gets promoted sometimes, about that busloads of people are being shipped from Chicago to some other place in Illinois. That's not happening. It hasn't happened. It's not going to happen. We are receiving busloads of people from the state of Texas without any prior notice of their arrival, sometimes in the middle of the night. Why do they do that? Because they want to cause chaos. We have managed to rein it in so that it's not chaos. And indeed, our goal here is to help people get to their hearings, to get determined whether they actually can have legal asylum and stay in the United States or be deported by that hearing. But it's our job, I believe, to act in a humanitarian fashion. It's what Illinois, I believe, stands for. It's who we are as Illinoisans, and we will care for them. You know, we believe that comprehensive border security as well as immigration reform will help us manage this in years going forward, but we're going to do everything we can right now.
So the governor, downplaying what he says is the hysteria that's shared on social media of people worried that these migrants are going to be moved out of Chicago into other places throughout Illinois. I mean, that's something that even Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson had pushed for in previous statements. But a couple of things there you can hear people push back on, and that is the idea that these all are asylum seekers. You've even got people like, former Border Patrol official Tom Homan, in an exchange that he had with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez about this issue. And whether or not these quote unquote asylum seekers are going through legal ports of entry or if they're just crossing the border illegally, whether or not they should be treated as asylum seekers if they're not going through those ports of entry. Is it safe to say that all those individuals in Chicago from the southern U.S. border are here as asylum seekers? The governor, as you heard, spells that out in his thoughts, that indeed they are all asylum seekers. But I would imagine you've got people who say, well, prove it. Let's see all their documents. Let's see exactly how they crossed the border and whether or not their asylum request is legitimate, rather than just being given a card to say, I fear my life and, livelihood and need to get out of my country and move to a safer place. Those types of questions still looming. But you've got the overall cost of this to the taxpayers, and people in Chicago are very upset about feeling like they are being pushed to the side with resources going to the migrants. And we're talking about substantial resources, close to $700 million in taxpayer-subsidized health care coverage for non-citizens. You've got at least $1 billion or so that has already been paid by state and city taxpayers in direct services to the migrants. You've also got another supplemental that's going to be coming. The city of Chicago approving $70 million, I believe, and the state's already saying they're going to offer up $180 million. In Cook County, another $70 million. So all of this stacking up, and the governor being asked about sanctuary state status. And he says, listen, this is really just an effort to not comply with federal immigration law. If there's somebody in this country that's undocumented and they don't have any other criminal charges against them, then they can't be the state and local law enforcement are prohibited from assisting federal immigration officials from detaining these individuals and helping to deport them. But then you get into the conversation, which is a much deeper dive, about the electoral process. And while some are worried that undocumented citizens are going to try to vote, they can already vote in city school council races in Chicago. It's prohibited that they cannot vote in federal elections, but there are concerns some have of the mail-in voting prospects and people ineligible to vote getting their hands on some of those mail-in ballots. So that's a concern people have. But it goes even further than that. The apportionment every 10 years with the U.S. Census. This was a big fight before the 2020 census, where you remember former President Donald Trump. He wanted to make sure there was a citizenship question on the census, and that went through the courts and they ultimately blocked that question. But when it comes to apportionment, you can boost the congressional apportionment in states like Illinois or California or New York if you have more people living there, citizen or not. So in a state like Illinois that has lost congressional seats because of a decade of population decline, I mean, we've lost like a dozen seats or something in the past 25 years or so because of declining population in the state of Illinois. Well, if you have a influx of tens of thousands of people who quote unquote are seeking asylum, and then you have another census come around, those numbers are going to boost the census numbers in a state like Illinois, thereby giving that state more congressional representation and, in effect, more sway in the Electoral College. Because right now we have 19 electoral votes, 17 congressional seats and two senators. So 19 electoral votes in the state of Illinois. If 10 years from now with the new census, we get a few more because of the tens of thousands of non-citizens in the state being counted for apportionments, then you can boost those numbers and have more sway in the Electoral College. So that's, again, another deeper conversation that we really have yet to see hashed out or even have the governor asked about. So, again, something else to really consider in this overall conversation when it comes to how exactly the migrant situation is impacting the state of Illinois, taxpayers, and beyond. So we'll watch that space, as always, here with Bishop on Air. Like, subscribe, hit that notification bell. Appreciate you guys being here each and every weekday morning. Illinois House passed 324 bills last week. 324 bills. They've still got a month left of legislative session, and that includes the movement towards a budget. But a couple of things that I definitely want you to keep an eye out for is other non-budget things that are happening. So we'll take a look at just some of the legislation and also what they're not working on. And I want to encourage you to go to thecentersquare.com/Illinois, where you can see headlines like Pritzker, state prepared for possible protest at Democrats' convention. Illinois bill would ban corporal punishment in private schools. Bill enhancing penalties for threats against libraries, stalls. And you've also got this story here. Legislator warns of subject to appropriation blank checks and audit findings. This is something that is always fascinating to see when you're listening to these these House floor action days where bills come up and it's just bill after bill after bill after bill of subject to appropriation, subject to appropriation. And you hear this a lot. And one state's representative, Fred Crespo, he got up and go check out the video if you can at thecentersquare.com. It's just example after example after example of a bill that comes up for a new program like, some kind of agriculture program using tax dollars to fund certain farm programs. Another measure that was subject to appropriation dealt with the impacts of art programs and investigating that. Another measure allows for state agencies to rework a web portal for a state-run program, subject to appropriation. There were even measures dealing with electric vehicles and recreational trails that were subject to appropriation, all part of the 324 bills that passed. But when you have something subject to appropriation, State Representative Fred Crespo, he spelled out that not a lot of times do those new line items get filled out. And then it's just an empty program. Sure, you can have a headline saying we passed this program, but if there's no dollars appropriated to that, then the program's not going to get off the ground. And that could lead to audit findings against that state agency, which aren't good. But also Representative Crespo talked about how when you have something that's, quote, subject to appropriation, it really takes the power of the purse away from the legislative branch of government and gives it to, you know, agency officials to have essentially like a blank check or to just not do anything with the program at all. And there was one case that Crespo even had. It was trying to clean up a bill from 20 years ago, he said. And it was an effort that Illinois State Police had audit findings of dealing with the Arsonist Registration Act. And he said on the House floor, and again, go check out the video at thecentersquare.com. He said on the House floor that this bill was passed 20 years ago to create this arsonists registration statewide database, but it was never funded because back then it was passed and it was, quote, subject to appropriation. So he kind of chuckled a bit, reminiscing about this cleanup bill 20 years later to actually fund the creation of this arsonist registration program. So that's an interesting conversation when you look at the 324 bills that the House passed. And these are just measures that the House passed. The Senate also has separate legislation that they've been passing as well. But I'm just going to, you know, take a look here briefly at some of the measures. You've got a measure that would, you know, limit how close a video gaming parlor can be to certain places like schools. You've got a measure that deals with pretrial services when it comes to the Safety Act and setting up a statewide pretrial service program subject to appropriation. You've got others that would require that school districts tell families and students about mental health services that they have available. There's a measure from State Representative Cam Buckner, House Bill 4500, which is interesting. And I do want to pause on this one just for a moment so we can see what this language does. And this measure passed the House last week, 68 to 36. What it does is it essentially redefines a variety of different criminal charges that can be pressed against people dealing with unlawful use of a weapon, unlawful use of a weapon by felons or persons in custody of the Department of Corrections, aggravated unlawful use of a weapon, being an armed habitual criminal, unlawful use of firearm projectiles, unlawful use of a firearm in the shape of a wireless telephone to unlawfully possession of weapons, unlawful possession of weapons by felons or persons in the custody of the Department of Corrections facilities, aggravated unlawful possession of a weapon, persistent unlawful possession of a weapon, unlawful possession of firearm projectiles, and unlawful possession of a firearm in the shape of a wireless phone. Provides that if any person before the effective date of the amendatory act has been arrested, charged, prosecuted with those, then the charges of the names of the defendants of unlawful use shall be changed. And if you read through, you can see the amendments. And this was debated in the House committee, and law enforcement groups were opposed because it ultimately meant that if this thing becomes law, they're going to have to retroactively go back and change these unlawful use of a weapons charges to unlawful possession, which, you know, is a different terminology altogether. So interesting to see that measure ultimately on its way to the Illinois Senate. So that's just one of the 324 different types of bills that passed. You've got others impacting employers, dealing with allowing for employees to review their disciplinary files. You've got measures dealing with employers saying that the state wants to prevent discrimination based on family responsibilities in employment. You've got a measure that passed to allow for local municipalities to increase property taxes for aquariums and museums. You've got a whole host of other things that were passed along party lines, and some of them increasing taxpayer costs, others impacting employers, others impacting criminal law. But one thing that they did not address yet is the Invest in Kids School Scholarship Program. And this is the program that expired at the end of last year. And apparently the last year was a big year. A story you can find at thecentersquare.com. Education expert analyzes Invest in Kids' record-breaking numbers for the final year. This was a program that was put into place, a tax credit program that used private donations to scholarship-granting organizations in an effort to get parents the ability to send their kids to a school of their choice, parents of a certain economic threshold. And this was passed back in, I believe, 2017. It was part of an agreement with the Republican governor at that time, Bruce Rauner, to change the school funding formula. And they said, well, if we're going to change the school funding formula to increase K through 12 education funding by $350 million a year, then let's have this school choice scholarship program. And it was in effect, and you had tens of thousands of students take part in this. And the most recent reports on this shows just how successful it was. And in particular, the American Federation of Children, they reported the program saw over 15,000 students in its last academic year, marking a significant increase from prior years. But despite the bipartisan efforts to bring about a renewal of this program. It has not been discussed yet. And again, what the program did is it offered a 75% income tax credit for private donations to school granting organizations. Last week, I ran into a family, Darnell Starks of Peoria. He was there with his granddaughters, Maya Starks and Mia Brinson. And Darnell talked about the impact this has had on his grandchildren and their education. And how detrimental it is if this does not get renewed.
Yeah, well, we've been very concerned that the state legislature hasn't renewed this program because without it, these two can't attend the school of their choice. And it's been a perfect fit for them, particularly for Maya. She was born in Scotland and we moved back after being missionaries overseas when she was 12. And it's a small school and she likes the environment there. Mia is playing volleyball there and excelling in the school. And without the scholarship, we just don't have the funds to afford it. So we are trying to do everything we can to convince people that these are the students that taking this program away would hurt. And hopefully we can get someone to listen to us.
And Maya Starks talked about the success she's had at the school of her choice and why it's important she feels to be able to continue to go to that school under the Invest in Kids program, which again has expired.
We've just been able to believe in our faith of like Christianity and have friends who also support that and just be free in what we believe and have teachers that support us and are willing to uplift us. And in public schools, obviously, a lot of the teachers don't believe in what we believe in, and sometimes it can be difficult to be understood or express our beliefs and what we are willing to learn and what we want to understand. And sometimes that's not received by other students and even teachers, and even just with bullying and other things in other schools, it's been difficult. But at this school, I've found groups of people who support me and are willing to grow with me, and it's a good environment to be in, and I don't want to have to be taken away from that and put in a new environment with new people as I've grown and developed in this school.
So clearly, you can see that the students here pushing for the continuation of this program, but 324 bills that passed the House last week, none of them dealt with the Invest in Kids program, even though there has been bipartisan support to extend this, even some looking to maybe modify it a bit, reduce the income tax credit, maybe reduce the threshold of how much could be donated and so on. But Darnell, he talked about the concern they have and the trouble it has for them in their feeling and awareness of their grandchildren's success in life if this program is not re-upped.
Yeah, well, it just brings some anxiety because we don't know what the future holds, but we've heard no backup plan. I've not heard anything about Pure Christian closing or any private donors coming in. And so we are people of faith, and so we're just praying that that God makes a way somehow, but right now we don't know how it will happen.
So a lot more to be said about the Invest in Kids School Choice Scholarship Program, especially as several private schools announced that they will close at the end of the school year because a lot of their students relied on the Invest in Kids School Choice Scholarship Program, including St. Bede School in Ingleside announcing it's going to have to shut its doors unless the program's renewed. Even after $500,000 fundraising effort came in, wasn't enough to shore up the school's costs. Interesting to see all of that. We'll be tracking the Illinois legislature. Again, go to thecentersquare.com/Illinois for the latest. And like, subscribe, and hit that notification bell here with Bishop On Air. Appreciate you guys being here each and every weekday morning with Bishop On Air. That's all I got for you today. Appreciate that. James Bond Jr., good show, he says. Keith, good morning. Deadron, Chris, Dr. Fark, Doobie Lou, JL, Save the Humans, Henry, Bob, Rawhide, Jim, Ernie's Arms Accessories. You guys are definitely active in the live chat. And I think sometime this week I'm going to have to get back over to the Discord and open that up so we can take some live calls. It's been a bit since we've done that. But again, a programming note, I'm off Friday. And I'm off Monday. So no live program there, just so you guys are fully aware. All right, have yourselves a great day. We'll be back at it tomorrow here with Bishop on Air. Really do appreciate you guys. It's humbling to look at how many of you guys are watching this live, and then all of the views that there are throughout the day. So I really do appreciate you putting trust in me, of all people. So have yourselves a great day, and we'll see you back here in short order. It's Bishop on Air. Yes, even gingers need vacation. Save the humans. Deal with it.